Well, let's talk a little bit about you and bring me up to date on what you're doing. And you're not working at the Reader's Digest anymore, I assume.
No, I'm not working at the Reader's Digest. I left there, I guess it's 4 years ago now, to finish that book of letters, although I had told them that I was almost done with it. Well, a lot of things made me leave there, I think. One of which is I realized how hard he'd... When I put together the book of letters, I realized how tough his life had been, and that if you wanted to be a writer, you just had to be a writer. You didn't wait around for it to get easy. I hadn't really known that until I put together the book of letters. He was so talented, you just think, well, he's talented, I'm not, he wants to be a writer, that's okay, I'll have a job, right? But then you look at what his life was really like, and you realize that he had a terrible time. He really, you know, nobody made it easy for him.
Let me get you. You've got to get up closer.
All right. Okay.
Closer.
All right.
6 inches.
All right. I'm afraid of getting. No, I'm afraid of getting too close. Is that right?
Yeah. Because you have a soft voice.
So I mumble.
Yeah. So you, I know. I should have brought the book of letters that you edited. Yes, he had a surprising life. I guess he kept it pretty well hidden from most people.
Well, I thought I knew more about him than I did about anybody else, and maybe I did know more about him than I did about anybody else. It turned out there were some central things I didn't know. I didn't know that he was bisexual. But I also didn't know, and that was central, because he was, in fact, you wouldn't have thought that. I certainly didn't think it. But I also... I didn't know that he'd had such a tough time. I didn't know that he had really tried to get jobs and hadn't been able to get them. I didn't know that it had taken him so long to write a novel. I didn't know that his stories were turned down even late in his life. These were all things that I learned when I put together the book. And that made me think, well, really deciding to be a writer is not... You don't wait to be chosen. You choose. So I thought, well, maybe I'll try it. So I did. But
it's scary, though, to follow the legacy, isn't it?
Well, I'm also, yeah, it's scary, and I think that it's easy to make unflattering comparisons, and I expected, the book has been very well treated, I expected a lot more unflattering comparisons to be made than have been made so far. But if you think about it in terms of... if you think about it in terms of the best you can do, then it's okay. I mean, I run a lot. I'm a long-distance runner, and I know I'll never be a world-class runner, but I get to the point where I've run my best race. And if you think about it in those terms, then the comparisons are not as important.
It's unfair, too, because you are your own man, even though you have decided to do similar to that your father did. It's a problem. Kingsley Amis and his son Martin Amis. Kingsley Amis is probably the preeminent man of letters in England, and his son Martin is a maverick. And I don't know if you're familiar with Martin's work.
Yes, I am. Yes.
But at the beginning, they have these same invidious comparisons. But what Martin did, his work is so spectacularly different from his father, to the degree that his father can't even read it. So, but obviously these comparisons were made, but he came into his own.
Yes, he came bursting into his own. I think his first book, everyone realized what a talent that was. And I'm delighted, and I think my father would also be flattered by the comparison of families. But also writing is very individual. It's not, I had thought for a long time that I could learn to write just like Daddy did, just exactly like Daddy did. And I realized, it took me a long time, but I finally realized it's just as it's decent writing, not even good writing, but decent writing is as personal as a fingerprint. You can't do what someone else does. It's always going to be different. And that was kind of a relief to understand that, that my writing was going to be different than his, no matter how hard I tried to make it the same, and just to relax and write the way I would.
That's interesting what you said about it being as different as a fingerprint or something like this. You could try to draw or paint in the style of someone else, but it's not your style. You have to fake it.
That's
very,
right.
Very seldom do you find an artist, two artists who draw or paint in a similar style. It's almost like it's impossible, like handwriting.
It is impossible. I think it. You can do an adequate, and I play with this in the book, you can do... an imitation which is good enough for people who don't understand the original to accept. But people who really understand and appreciate the original are going to know immediately that this is an imitation, that it's a second rate. I could be a second rate John Cheever, but I can be a first rate Ben Cheever. I mean, Ben Cheever may not be as desirable as John Cheever, but I can never be a first rate John Cheever, because the imitation just takes too much energy.
And you can't do it successfully anymore.
You can't. No. But I mean, you could do something that would, you talk about painting. I mean, you can do something that the people who counterfeit paintings, you can do something that passes the casual inspection. For one thing, I don't think it's any fun. It must not be any fun for those people because they're not expressing themselves at all. But it never has the thing that makes the original worthwhile in it.
Well, you have a whole family dynasty now with your father. Your mother, Mary, is a poet, and Susan is both fiction and nonfiction writers, so that makes the family fairly well complete, huh?
Well, I've got a younger brother, and I expect him to start writing soon. We didn't.
How old is he?
He's 9 years younger than I am, which makes him 33.
Does he have any literary aspirations himself?
He's a very good writer. I think he's a very good writer. He's a lawyer now. He's been he was a lawyer for the Sierra Club. He just had a baby. So he's pretty busy, but I think it's all. See, we didn't belong to a family. We belonged to a cult that, which had a priest that was my father, and he was a writer, and the thing you did, if you were worth anything, was write. So we all felt that. It was also, at least for me, I was also taught that there was only one person who really wrote in the family, and that was him. So it was a little bit of a bind, but there was no question in his mind. Well, there was no question in my mind from the impression I took away from him that there was a worthwhile thing a person could do, and that was right. And everything else that other people did, while it was understandable and interesting, was just a little bit ridiculous. And I don't even know if he really felt like that, but he sure gave me that impression.
No, wait. To what degree did he give you encouragement?
He didn't give me a lot of encouragement, as a matter of fact. I think he wanted something for me that I don't think he wanted me. I don't know what he wanted for me. I'm not sure he knew. He wanted me to be a good person, and he didn't want me to do anything that was threatening in a big way. Also, I didn't want to. We were kind of in agreement on this. I was a go-along, get-along sort of guy. But it was clear that his writing was terribly important to him. He had to write. He couldn't have lived for a day without writing. It was also clear to me that what he did was important. I thought it was important. I didn't think it was just something the world thought it was important. I also thought it was important. And he was sometimes encouraging, but it was very spotty. You know, he once said that he once said, would you like to write a novel? He said, I guess I was 23 and I was married and had a kid. And I said, I can't afford to write a novel. And he said, well, how much would you need? And I said, well, I'd need $10,000. And he said, well, I'll give you a check for $10,000. And I waited for a minute, and then I said, no, thank you. And I think I was right. I think if I'd accepted a check from him for $10,000, I would have just been paralyzed.
Oh, it'd be like a sort of Damocles over your head.
Yeah.
You take the money and say, jeez, I got to turn this out. And I can just see one getting a writer's block working under that kind of pressure.
Well, I'm glad you agree. Yeah, that's how I think I was right to turn it down.
Well, it's great to get a stake, you know, it's a grant or a fellowship or something like that. Or perhaps if you are fully competent, you're halfway along a novel, you need that extra mile, you know, of help, maybe you could accept something like that. But to start off from scratch with that, and then expect to complete it in a year or 2 years, and expect it to be a sellable book. I mean, that's tough. It's hard enough to write without that kind of pressure.
Also, for him, I mean, when people pay for something, they make it their own to some extent. It would have had to have been a book that he found acceptable, which would have been very difficult for me to do at 23, I think.
Well, we're talking about John Cheever because in your novel, The Plagiarist, there is a John Cheever-like father in the book, and I don't think there's much doubt that the father is in many respects based on your own father, because we know now about the heavy drinking, and although the bisexuality does not play a role in this book, but obviously the father in the book is molded after John. I'm not going to deny that.
No, I think that's fair, and I think it's fair to him. But he was very important to me when I sat down to write. I had to write about him. Probably someone once asked me, "Are you ever going to get to the point where you write books that don't have your father in them? When you're going to get over your father?" And I said, "No, I don't think I ever will." And then I went a step further and said, "And I like to think that I'll frighten my own children sufficiently so that they'll never get over me. I don't think you really get over your father. I think you can come to terms with him, but I think a father is just too important to get over. And you have to come to terms with him. I also think you have to come to a kind of, now this may, people may disagree, but I think you have to come to an understanding with your father. I think if you don't, it becomes a curse. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Though? I mean, I was never able to do it with mine.
Well, maybe I was lucky. I mean, in a way, I had a tremendous disadvantage. He was a famous guy, and he was a very tricky guy. In another way, I had a tremendous advantage, which is that there was a big course I could take. There was all this reading material, which most sons don't have. And also, he was very, while he kept secrets, he was also enormously open. In a way, I knew a whole lot about him, although there were some essential things I didn't know. Also, maybe you don't even have to come to terms with a real father. Maybe you just have to come to terms. You have to get to a point where you think you understand, or you've created a model, or that you think is acceptable in order to go on. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I think so.
I know people who've decided. And I know some people who are pretty successful, but I wonder about it, who've decided that their father was, not worth considering. And I always think, and I tell them this, that they're going to be in trouble. Because eventually that mirror, you know, when you look in the mirror, you often see your father's face. Do you sometimes see your father's face when you look in the mirror? Okay. I'm confident about that because I once worked at a mental hospital, and even the old schizophrenics would see their father's face in the mirror. They'd say, "That's my father," you know, when they looked in the mirror. So if you decide that that person who you're going to see in the mirror is worthless, then you're in trouble, I think. Or bad in any unforgivable way.
I think most of us. Now, that's true. There are some people who see their fathers as worthless, perhaps, and their mothers do. But most of us look, especially when you're young, you see your parents as gods. And you don't see their vulnerabilities until you yourself are mature. And I was always intimidated by my father. And he's 85 years old and living in an adult assisted community. And he's lost his mental faculties. But until that happened,
this is an interview about you.
Several years ago, I took my family to visit my father and mother in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
And always he would let me borrow his car. He would meet us at the airport. And he suggested that perhaps I take my family to San Antonio for the weekend, and I took it in his car. No, I took them in his car, no problem. We got back on Sunday, and I said, "Dad, I've never been to Gilly's. Always wanted to go to Gilly's. I wonder if I could borrow the car so my wife and I can go." He said, "No." He said, "No." He said, "I don't approve of Gilly's. All these wild cowboys." He says, "You can go to Gilly's if you want, but you can't take my car." Now here I'm a grown man, I was in my 40s by then, and I just gotten back in his car from San Antonio, and he wouldn't let me take his car to Gilly's. I was furious. I didn't show up, but I was livid. I was furious. So the following summer I went back, and I announced to my father, I said, "Dad, I'm renting a car at the airport."
Uh-huh.
He said, "You can't do that." I said, "Yeah, I can. It's going to be easy." He said, "I don't want three cars in my driveway." I said, "I'll leave it out on the street. it's easier for me to rent a car. You don't have to drive to the airport and pick us up and all of that. And that's the way it was ever since. I found that even though I was a grown man, I was still intimidated by him, but I found that I had to make a break and develop my own independence, and I couldn't let him do that to me anymore.
Uh-huh.
Unfortunately, that following year, Gillies burned down, so I never did see it.
You don't think your father had anything to do with that?
No, I think Mickey Gilly, I think, had something to do with that. So at any rate, I am sure that you grew up to a certain degree intimidated by your father, mm-hmm. because that's the way it is.
Yes, yes, or was in our generation. Maybe different for our children. I don't know. I don't know. I'm glad to hear this because, I mean, I'm happy to talk because I think sometimes people see this book and talk to me and they say, well, it must have been so different for you. In some ways it was different, but in many ways it's the same. I think every father is a problem for every son and every son is a problem for every father and it's a problem that has to be solved.
I'm not sure it's ever solved.
And I'm not sure it's ever solved either. But it's a problem that has to be confronted. It's a problem that... I don't mean to say that you need to fight with it. A person needs to fight with his father. I was always very reluctant to fight with my father. But it's just very important. It's just one of those essential things. It's not an issue you can escape, I don't think. Or that's my experience. I remember when I was in college, people were going to Canada to avoid the draft. And you'd hear people talk at great lengths about going to Canada, and they'd never mention their families. And I always thought that was absurd, because I thought that if they were the way I was, that would probably be one of the big determining factors as to whether they were willing to live the rest of their lives in Canada. But they didn't want to admit it. It was a thing they didn't want to talk about.
Now, in The Plagiarist, the young protagonist works at a... I can't remember the name of the publication.
It's The American Reader.
The American Reader, very similar to the Reader's Digest. And the young man is kind of hippie-ish with the longish hair. It's not quite what the American Reader would expect. Were you kind of like that young man?
Well, I had gone to Antioch. I had been, I'd had long hair. I'd been arrested in an anti-war demonstration. I was not uncommonly active, but I was a member of my generation. And I did go to work at a large publication magazine, a magazine that lost, I think, 30,000 readers a month to failed eyesight. The magazine with the largest readership of any magazine in the world. And it was
not the one based in Pleasantville, New York.
No, not that magazine. And it was a difficult transition. I've talked with other people who read the book, and they say that a lot of people in my generation, you know, you went to college and you thought your parents were absurd and their world was ridiculous, and then you came home and you got married and suddenly you had to have a job, and it turned out that you had to come to some immediate accommodation with the world as you had happily rejected it. Up until that moment.
Had you also worked in a small newspaper?
I had worked in a small newspaper. I worked at one of the Gannett newspapers for 5 years. Mm-hmm. This is not in the book, but actually at the newspaper I worked, the advertising people were on the top floor. I think I say this in the book. And the business people were in the middle floor, and the reporters were in the basement. And in the newspaper I worked at, it was actually true for a couple of weeks that when the advertising people flushed the toilet, it emptied into the stall, which was used by the men reporters in the newsroom. So you'd see you had to be very quick on your feet if you were going to use that bathroom, because if you heard a gurgling sound, it meant that someone in advertising had flushed the toilet. It was that the status of being a writer. Was that clearly marked, I think.
I was pleased to note that Arthur's wife in the book, and I think one of the executives for the American Reader were Ohio University graduates, happens to be my alma mater.
Is that right?
That's right. So I was happy to see those references, and I knew it was Ohio University and not Ohio State.
That's right. They're very different. I think Ohio University was, at least was then, a very good college. Much better than Antioch, where I
actually... Well, Antioch was so different. I mean, it was like a radical school with... mean, I looked at Antioch myself. I considered that, but I wanted to study journalism. And
well, you made the wise choice no matter what you wanted to study. I say in the book, and this is actually true from life, that someone wrote in the administration building in the stall at Antioch, they had these little toilet paper dispensers that give you individual sheets, and someone wrote above it, Antioch diplomas, take one, flush $25,000 down the toilet, which seemed, the stall was immediately repainted, which was quite uncharacteristic for Antioch. The administration didn't want this kind of...
Well, I thought it was a wonderful school, an experimental school. I think they had a disaster with their law school in Washington.
Well, it had been a wonderful school. This is the thing where the reputation survives the excellence. It had been a wonderful school. It was not when I went there. It was breaking up. There were still intelligent people there, but there was the level of nonsense was so high that you couldn't get a college education there. You really couldn't. I mean, you could go to the library as I did and read books, but you couldn't. You'd write a big paper, and there was no one who wanted to read it. You know, so they'd weigh it, and give you a grade on it. I mean, really, it was. It sounds absurd, but it was
a non-structured school. I don't think they gave grades or anything. Isn't that right?
Well, that's right. But it had been a non. In order to make an institution like that work, you have to be very formal and very in another way. And I guess they had been at one point, and it attracted good people, and it graduated good students. By the time I got there, it was breaking down. People would stand up in class and say, "Why should I study biology when, when the ghettos are burning?" And it was an interesting question, but you didn't learn any biology if people were standing up and saying that.
Well, Ohio University, of course, when I was there, that was in the late 50s, was a highly structured school, and you took exams and wrote papers and were graded, and you had to be in class. They set you alphabetically. They took attendance.
I think, I'm sorry, but I think all of that is very useful. I would have, if I had it to do over again, I would have gone to a place a lot more like Ohio University and not to Antioch.
But young people don't really like all that structure. They may need it, but if I'd had my choice, I probably would have cut class. But you couldn't do it. You cut more than two or three or four classes without an excuse, and they would chop your grade or sometimes dismiss you from the class. So you had to be there.
Well, I think that's a good idea. I'm sorry to be so repressive, but I think that's a good idea. I mean, we were actually encouraged practically not to go to classes at Antioch. I took a class that was a required education course. This was required if you wanted to be a teacher. And the title of the class was When Drawing is Singing and Dancing. When Drawing is Singing and Dancing. It was nonsense. It was just plain nonsense. It was kind of Zen, this is of no use. If you want to grow spiritually, I think you should be encouraged to do so on your own, time, not in a required course. I mean, it was absurd. And I'm as interested in experiment as anyone, but I thought that was just nonsense. A high university, the girls wear skirts, they look pretty.
I'll say, I was on the National Alumni Board for 3 years. I would go back two or three times a year. Boy, they look great. Those girls look great. They still do, I tell you.
At Antioch,
they haven't changed.
I'm sure they haven't. At Antioch, the fashion for a while, and of course there were attractive girls at Antioch, but the fashion for a while was to have your blue jeans would rip right around the crotch if you were a girl, and you would replace the missing fabric with a piece of fur. I'm not making this up. With a piece of fur. So you'd see girls with ripped blue jeans, and in their crotch there was a piece of fur had been stitched in. This is, I suppose for some people this is, is intoxicating, but I thought it was repulsive.
So Arthur, graduate of Antioch and kind of a long-haired hippie style, I guess he was the token hippie at the American Reader. Huh?
That's right. When he gets the job.
He needed one.
That's right. When he gets the job, the father figure, and my father didn't actually say this, but he probably thought it, says, well, he's what they need, a hippie in a tract house is who they want to hire. And that's what Arthur was for the American Reader, and that's what I was. Although there were a lot of hippies in tract houses right around there.
Tell me about your career at the Reader's Digest, because even though there's a lot of discontent and in fact, a feeling of contempt in the book for the American Reader, It seemed like a terrific place to work. I mean, most of us would love jobs
well,
like that.
It was. When I first went there, it was. It was like Camelot. I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. There was this wonderful old couple, and rumor had it that if you did something worthwhile, they would give you an enormous check on top of your salary. There were a lot of articulate, intelligent people. After working for a little local newspaper, it was magnificent. And there is contempt, I think, for the magazine in this book, but I hope no more contempt for the magazine than there is for the protagonist. That if you have, as I do, a very critical eye, then the best thing you can do is pass it over yourself as well as everyone else. And the one thing I do want to say, which I keep saying, but I really mean it, is that I hope nobody comes away with the impression that I feel superior to people who read the Reader's Digest. A lot of people do feel superior to them. I don't. I think there are a lot of just terrific people who read the Reader's Digest, people who've led lives that are probably better than the life I'm going to live. If the Reader's Digest falls out of someone's briefcase, he's probably not going to mug you. The chances are he'll give you money to buy a token. These things are very important. And when I was criticized by my old radical friends, as I was, for getting a job at the Reader's Digest, I used to say to them, I know you don't like it, but this is the people's magazine. The people may not be who you thought they were supposed to be. The people were supposed to be crazed Russian proletarians, I think, but this is the people's magazine.
Well, that's the magazine my father subscribed to, and I always used to say I grew up with the great books. They were the Reader's Digest condensed books. That's all he had. I think my mother and father had one shelf library, and they were all Reader's Digest condensed books.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there are wonderful books that don't make it to Reader's Digest condensed books.
And some good ones may making it into the Reader's Digest. I did do an interview with, I can't remember the name of the guy now, but he was the head of the books division. He came in, we did an interview. And he explained their philosophy. It was clear that, for example, you wouldn't find Sophie's Choice, as he pointed out. Mm-hmm. They had a suicide pact at the end, and these books had to be more uplifting. And sex began as soon as the door closed. You didn't go beyond that door. These were very carefully and skillfully condensed to give the flavor of the book, but without a lot of the nitty gritty.
Well, that's right. But the Wallaces, who founded the magazine and who ran it, did everything for a long, long time, or oversaw everything. Well, really, I think, and I've been attacked for this position, not only verbally but in the press. They were extraordinary people. They were enormously generous. Their convictions you could disagree with, but they were their convictions. Mr. Wallace, and he asked everyone to call him Wally, but everyone called him Mr. Wallace. His name was DeWitt. DeWitt Wallace. Now there's a middle name too, but he, he gave most of what he earned away. He couldn't bear the idea of anyone being in need. He used to drive. He had this old car, and he owned the whole thing, the whole shooting match. Really owned it. I mean, he wasn't chairman of it. He owned it, and he'd drive home from work and pick people up who were walking to the bus stop, who worked at the company, and ask them what they thought. If there was anything they thought that was wrong with the place that ought to be changed. And he'd listen to what they said. And he used to say that when you die, the only thing you bring with you, the only thing you have, I can't get it exactly, the only thing you have clutched in your hands when you die is the only things you have are the things you've given away. He was really quite an inspiring figure, and so was she.
Except for the last edition of the Reader's Digest. Going to take that with him into the game. But it was interesting the way the magazine worked. I noticed that if the editors were interested in a certain subject, they would actually commission it and have it printed in another magazine so that they could then adapt it and put it in their own.
That's right.
Their policy, I guess, was not to publish any original material.
Well, no. They published, when I was there, it got up to about 60-70% original material. It was supposed to be kept close to 50%. 50% original, digest originals, and 50% picked up from other places. And it's true that there was a placement policy for which the magazine, I think, was fairly justly attacked in the 40s. The New Yorker did a hilarious send-up of the Digest called The Little Wonder, which it was a very funny book, which it, one of the things it attacked was the placement policy. Yes, they used to commission articles, give them to other magazines, and then pick them up and condense them to keep the percentage down. But about 50% of that stuff, starting in the 50s, it got to be a higher and higher percentage, was produced with the Digest in mind. But even the original writers wrote two or three times the length that the article was supposed to be, so that us hundreds of editors had something to do.
Now, you became an associate editor there.
I finally was a senior editor, and had been promised even further promotions when I finally left. But you never know.
Now, how happy were you working at the Reader's Digest?
Well, you know, I had times when I was very happy, and I had times when I was acutely unhappy. I had
just like here.
Yeah, that's right. I'm sure. That's, you know, if someone said to me, someone who's probably never read the Digest and maybe never been in the straits that I was, said, you must have had to have a sense of irony to work for the Reader's Digest. Well, you know, I think you have to have a sense of irony to work anywhere. I think you have to have a sense of irony to walk down the street. I had friends there. There were points in my career when I had friends there I was devoted to, and they were devoted to me, and I really liked them. There were jobs I did there that I liked a lot. I was editor of Life in These United States for a while. That was fairly satisfying.
Those are the little anecdotes.
That's right. And I say in the book that we run between nine, the magazine used to run between, see, I still say we, 9 and 11 of those a month, and they got 15,000 submissions for those 11 slots.
And you had to go through those 15,000?
Well, no, there were outside readers who didn't. But the joke is, if 15,000 people think they have an amusing little story to tell, probably 9 of them do. Unfortunately, in conversation, you have to hear off.
And you still buy it? Does the Reader's Digest appear on the newsstands?
Yes, it does.
I haven't looked for it in recent years.
Well, no, it's still there. And newsstand sales are more important than they used to be.
Because I know subscription was very important, especially, obviously, with the condensed books. I mean, that's just the way it was done, through the mail.
Well, subscription is still important to the magazine. The magazine, I think it's none of my... I could be quite mistaken, but I think the terrible mistake they made was in 1955 when they decided to take advertising. They decided to take advertising because they didn't want the newsstand price to go up. I think it was from 20 to 25 cents. It may have been from 25 cents to 30 cents. And, of course, the newsstand price now is more than $2. It's full of advertising, and as is often the case, advertising has something to say about the content of the magazine, which never did, of course, when you didn't take advertising.
Now, in The Plagiarist, the premise of the story is where Arthur, the young editor, is asked to commission his father to submit a story, an article for the magazine, which is kind of hilarious because the father in the book hated the American Reader. Tell me a little bit about this.
Well, it didn't happen the way it happens in the book, but it is true that my father came to lunch at the Reader's Digest. And it's also true that it was intimated to him that they would like him to write for them and that they would pay him any amount of money. It was kind of mysterious how much they would pay him. And then he and I were getting along pretty well, and he was at that stage in his life where he was quite sunny about the world. He was quite cheerful and felt that everything was going to work out. And I was at that stage of life where I thought the world was pretty tough. And I kept saying, you know, I'm working for the Reader's Digest, and you're and you're the one who's the optimist in the family. Now you should write a piece for the Reader's Digest. And he finally did. And they accepted it, and they ran it. I didn't write a word of it.
Was it on tomatoes or cats?
It wasn't on tomatoes or cats. It was on running, as a matter of fact, and I was a very serious runner. It's also true that a lot of the stories, and this is not such a good thing, that pass for nonfiction, some of the stories that pass for nonfiction in the Reader's Digest are, I suspect, fictional. And so that could have happened too. I mean, someone could make up a story if you're careful about how many witnesses you have. A heartwarming story, a particularly heartwarming story, it seems to me, is frequently made up. We just had an example in publishing that book, The Education of Little Tree. Mm. Supposed to be a nonfiction memoir of this guy. Now, I started to read this, and I have a pretty good ear for falsehood, having worked as a journalist for all these years. And I started to read that book because I'm interested in Indians, and I thought, this is nonsense. The guy wrote the book in 1975, and he's telling us what the fog looked like when he came home on his first day when he was 11 years old. And it's just, you know, it wasn't just that. It was just there was a kind of saccharine element to it. And sure enough, it turns out it was made up. The guy made it up completely. And that happens. Someone will make up a story. In this book, Arthur makes up a story which is supposed to be true. And they believe it.
Makes up a story about a cat who saves a family from some escaped convicts and passes it on to them as his father's original work. His father goes along with this, surprisingly.
That's right. I was pleased when I got to the point where I realized that if I had ever done that and if I'd gone to my father, he would have said just what the character in the book said. He would have he would have said, well, if you really want to do this, you can, but I don't, just as long as I don't have to read it. He would let me produce any level of saccharine story, but he wasn't gonna read it.
Eventually, you left the Reader's Digest and decided to work full time as a fiction writer. Of course, you edited the letters. That probably was a very time consuming process.
I edited the letters, which took a lot longer than it was supposed to take, and I worked on the journals and wrote the introduction for the journals, and the novel also took a lot longer than it was supposed to take.
So, since the time you left the Reader's Digest, in effect, you've brought three books out.
Well, I've played a part in the production of three books, yeah, since I left the Reader's Digest. And it's very gratifying, really it is. But I had gratifying times at the Reader's Digest too. there were wonderful things that happened. There was once in a while a story would come along that you just loved, and you could get it, if you could get it into the Reader's Digest, that was very gratifying. Or a joke would come along. There was a joke, a senator dies. Is this all right? It'll take a minute.
Go ahead.
A senator dies and he goes to heaven. It's very unusual for them to have senators in heaven. And they tell him they're going to fit him for wings, but before they do that, he should go to the cafeteria. So he goes to the cafeteria, and there's a big long line, which annoys him because he's a senator and he's not used to waiting on line. So he starts to cut the line, and an archangel steps out of the side of the room and says, this is heaven, and everyone's equal. We have to wait on line. So the senator goes back to the end of the line, and then along comes a man in a white jacket with a stethoscope around his neck and walks up to the front of the cafeteria and helps himself and sits down. And the senator is furious. He calls the archangel over, and he says, now, I'm a senator. I was a senator for many years, and along comes this doctor, and he doesn't have to wait in line. And the archangel's a little embarrassed. He says, well, he says, That wasn't a doctor. That was God. Sometimes God thinks he's a doctor, he says. So you could get a joke like that, and you could get it into the Reader's Digest, and that was pretty gratifying.
I also love the perks, though. I mean, there was a jitney that carried people, and
oh, it was
25-cent lunches.
That's right. There was a week a year, and this only lasted for about 3 years. There was a week a year, if you were an editor there, where you could do whatever you wanted. It didn't count as vacation. It wasn't charged against your month's vacation.
A sabbatical, huh?
A mini sabbatical. And they would pay for everything. And you were paid during that time. I took a train across the country from New York to Los Angeles.
You were expected to do something, not just rake leaves.
You had to do something, that's right. That's right. You were supposed to get in touch with readers, was the idea. But I think, you know, and there was great health benefits. It wasn't just the things that, although they were wonderful, it was the feeling that you were cared for, which is enormously important. I say in the novel that which is how people felt about Wallace, that there was no question that that people felt about Wallace the way people in the Middle Ages felt about God. There was no question that he existed, and there was no question that he was all-powerful. Whether he was all-powerful and good or just all-powerful was sometimes debated, but there was no question about that.
Well, it's a unique environment. Here at CBS, it's very heavily unionized. In fact, in 1988, I was on the picket line for 13 weeks when the Writers Guild went on strike. So it's not quite that same benign atmosphere that you had up in Pleasantville. So do you miss it at all?
Oh, sure. When I started this book, which went through about four long drafts and many, many pages which blessedly were thrown away, the first lead was, I dreamt last night I worked in paradise again. My first feeling was, I missed it terribly. Although I left. People leave a job and they always say they left it, and then you meet their former superior and he'll tell you that they were fired. Now, they may tell you now I was fired, but in fact I wasn't. In fact, I was offered things when I left.
Have you heard any reaction?
I've heard...
Your former colleagues?
The official... officialdom has been silent, but the people that I know who still work there who have worked there have been very nice about it. Many of them think it's quite funny.
And it is quite funny. Do you recall, we're almost out of time, just want to go back to your childhood days. Do you recall realizing that your father was a substantial literary figure and that there were important literary people, or did important literary people tramp through the house in and out?
Well, there were people who were very interesting, which I think is important, because literary people aren't always very interesting, but there were people. I knew that something interesting was going on. I was a little uncertain about my father's prestige, and there's a story, and this is in the Book of Letters, but when we were taking the transatlantic, when we went to Italy, I was 8 years old. There was a woman on the boat who saw my father and who suspected that he was John Cheever, the New Yorker writer, and who then kind of got interested in me, bought me ginger ales and stuff. And she said to me, you know, your father's a very famous man. And I said, no, he's not. She said, no, really, he is. He's a great writer, she said. And I said, no, I'm sure you've got the wrong guy. And she said, well, don't you ever see him write? And I said, well, he goes into this room in the house, but I really think he's just taking a nap. And then my father found out about this, and he was kind of interested in this woman, and he was quite sore at me, and explained to me that he was, if not a great writer, at least the person this woman was thinking of.
Well, The Plagiarist, a very funny novel by Benjamin Cheever. Benjamin, thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much.